A tiny turtle hatching washes up on a beach in northern New South Wales after devastating floods. Physically, he's uninjured, but he's not doing so well. It's a medical mystery. With his life on the line, he's rushed to a wildlife hospital. There, the vets make a shocking discovery. He swallowed plastic. How do we know? His scat told us. I'm Carlo Ritchie, and this is Scat Chat with WWF. Join me and WWF as we get to the bottom of what fascinating things scat or poo can teach us about the animals that made it, the homes they live in, and the problems they face. We'll also chat about what you can do at home to help your favorite animals thrive in the wild. Today I'm talking to Kate Noble so that we can find out what a tiny turtle pooing plastic tells us about our environment and what we can do to turn the tide. Kate, welcome to Scat Chat.
Thanks very much, Carlo.
Now, Kate, I mentioned a turtle there, but before I get to it, I want to talk about your specific role with WWF, which is as a policy manager in the No Plastics in Nature. Do I say program?
Initiative, program, either is fine.
New World Order?
Regime.
Yeah. So, Kate, I want to talk about this policy aspect. I mean, what does that look like? What is your day-to-day?
Well, that's music to my ears, Carlo, because not a lot of people want to talk about policy.
That's why you come to Scat Chat.
It's a really important piece of the puzzle. So what WWF does is it looks at the whole range of problems that are out there in relation to plastic pollution and the potential solutions to those, in particular policy solutions. And we work closely with businesses, with governments at all levels, and a whole range of stakeholders to understand which of those policies are going to work in Australia at all levels of government and in communities, and how we can implement those to really make sure that plastics are staying in the economy, kept out of nature, and that we can all really do our part to help to solve that problem.
A lot of the people we've talked to in Scat Chat work in the field. How do you work with Scat? I mean, what is it like when Scat crosses your desk?
Well, Scat doesn't come across my desk in a literal sense very often, which is a good thing.
Oh, we should all be so lucky, Kate.
We should all be so lucky. More often than not, I'm reading about Scat or I'm coming across it in the research. And certainly there's been a lot of amazing research in just the past couple of years looking at plastics in Scat. And that's really kind of the way how I interact with Scat.
So what does plastic look like when it is inside us? Are we talking about whole plastic bottles being found inside animals, or are we talking tiny bits of plastic? I mean, what is the scope of how we find plastic in bodies?
It depends on the species and it depends on the plastic product. Certainly large bits of plastics, which we call macroplastics, have been found in a lot of the larger marine species. So dolphins, turtles, whales, seals can all swallow large bits of soft plastic. You know, those kind of plastics that we can scrunch up, typically plastic bags. They are easily mistaken for jellyfish. So any animal that eats a jellyfish can come across a pretty large part of a plastic bag and consume that. That causes a huge amount of problems when it enters their digestive tract. It can block up their stomach. It can make them feel full without having any of the nutrients or having a full stomach. And then there's a category of plastics called microplastics, which a lot of people will have heard of. It can be a primary product in itself. So some microplastics are added to cosmetics, for example. Or it can be something that has been in the environment for such a long time that it's broken up into tiny pieces. And then it becomes tiny, tiny piece of microplastic, which you can probably see in your hand, but can be as small as a grain of sand or a bit bigger.
Why do we have these plastics? I mean, if they're so hard to break down, like there's huge damage that they do to the environment, why are we putting these plastics in things?
That's a really good question, Carlo. There's a lot of money to be made out of plastics. Part of how lucrative that business is around pushing convenience and consumer lifestyle. So we've all become really accustomed to using things for a tiny amount of time, which means we can pick them up and take them with us and sit on the beach or walk to work and then just throw them out. And when you think about it, you know, once you start kind of accumulating the levels of waste that accompanies that kind of lifestyle, it's absolutely enormous. You know, Australians consume something like 1.8 billion disposable coffee cups every year.
Gee whiz.
The volumes of this is just crazy.
How much are you using, Kate? Because that's just me.
1.8 on top of that. I have a reusable coffee cup. which I use every single day and make sure that I've got it in my car, in my bag, wherever I take it with me. But yeah, sorry to hear about that, Carlo. 1.8 billion is a lot.
I got an addiction, I guess. I'm having about 15 million coffees a day, and a lot of them I don't even need to drink. Earlier on, I mentioned this story of a turtle that plastic was found inside their poo. You were involved a little bit with this turtle. Can you tell us this story?
Yeah, absolutely. So this story about this little turtle came into us via some of the partners that we work with. Pretzel was a little turtle.
Pretzel is this turtle's name?
Pretzel's the turtle's name.
It's a great name for a turtle. Tiny and salty. Sorry.
Exactly. So Pretzel and a mate of his were taken in by a wildlife hospital and transferred to SeaWorld, where they were treated. They were looking pretty sick, and some x-rays revealed that they had microplastics in their gut. Now, these little guys were less than 6 months old. So by the age of 6 months, they'd already ingested sort of 4 or 5 pieces of plastic. And we know from research from the CSIRO that ingesting just one piece of plastic really increases the chance of a turtle dying. So these guys were really lucky. They were provided with a laxative. They managed to poop out most of the plastic. It just gives you a sense of, you know, these are just two turtles, right? And the number of turtles that are in the environment that are consuming plastic is just, we can't know exactly how many that is, but we know that all marine turtle species are affected by plastic pollution. And it's a big problem to these tiny little guys, even before they hit 6 months or a year of age.
Where is Pretzel now? Do you have any knowledge? Did he go out and live a full, happy life free of plastic? Is he out there encouraging people to recycle on the beaches of the north of New South Wales?
Pretzel has gone back into the wild, and that's a great outcome. And I really hope he's not kind of since then encountered more plastics in the environment.
I really like to imagine, Kate, that Pretzel's out there running a cooperative plastic recycling plant, and there's all the little turtles and they're all helping. And it's just a really cool vibe. He's got like recycled Crocs on. If it's so indulgent of me to have that dream, it's going to really help me get through thinking about how much plastic is in the sea. If I can imagine that Pretzel's out there doing one for all of us. This goes to a bigger question though, Kate, like why is this a problem? You mentioned there that we know that even just one little bit of plastic drastically affects a turtle's survivability. Why is this a problem?
The problem looks a bit different when we're talking about different species and again when we're talking about different pieces of plastic or different plastic products. Turtles, ingestion is a real problem and also entanglement. Now, entanglement is what we talk about when animals are becoming tangled up or kind of restricted or constrained by, for example, fishing gear that's been discarded at sea. That again causes serious injury and death. So really what we're talking about is plastic causing a range of serious injuries, diseases, illnesses, and death in marine species and quite a lot of marine species. We know that plastic pollution and again, microplastics cause real problems in reefs. So the coral can ingest plastic as well. And we now know that plastic is in some of the shellfish we eat, also in some of the drinking water we drink. So it's very much has entered the human food chain as well. Now, what we don't know a lot about is exactly what kind of health impacts that's going to have on us long term, but there are a couple of really small emerging, like sort of new studies that have looked at this. Some have found microplastics in baby poo.
How early are we talking? Are we talking like meconium first poos?
Yes, absolutely. They found microplastic in sort of the first couple of months of life and microplastic in meconium.
Gee whiz. What does that suggest then, that plastics entering while they're in utero through the placenta?
Well, look, again, this is one baby. So yes, it may suggest that. And in the older babies, certainly it's, you know, babies put everything in their mouth. They're walking around, they're licking the carpet, they're picking things up and they're shoving it in their mouth. So it's also indicative of the amount of plastic and the fact that that just doesn't stay in the product that is around us. So, you know, microfibers from carpet, for example.
Am I right? There's also this kind of plastic vortex somewhere out in the sea where like a bunch of different ocean currents meet and there's just this huge kind of continent essentially of plastic?
Sadly, there's more than one. So there are a handful of what we call garbage patches or gyres. They don't really look like kind of an island of plastic, but certainly, yes, the ocean currents, kind of the way they flow and converge means that There are big patches of plastic pollution, some of which is on the surface and some of which is underneath. It's a pretty scary reminder of what happens when we just leave plastic to kind of flow into the environment and what it can do there.
This is an interesting one because this is wholly a man-made substance, right? Plastic doesn't occur naturally. So any plastic that ends up in the environment is directly as a result of us. Am I right in saying that?
Yes and no. Conventional plastics are derived from fossil fuels, oil. That is wholly a kind of a human manufactured polymer. There are biopolymers around, and that's kind of an area that's kind of increasing in terms of investment and production. That is really sort of where naturally derived materials can be converted into polymers or plastics.
Right. And are those polymers as harmful? Can they be broken down, or are they like plastic as well? They just linger and linger and linger.
They can be broken down. This is a really complicated one. In the environment in the short term, they can cause exactly the same kind of harms. However, they can go into, for example, industrial or home composting. And these are the kind of the bioplastics or the compostable plastics that a lot of people use, for example, to line their food waste caddies. They will, in certain circumstances, either at home or in industrial facilities, they will fully biodegrade. But there's a whole range of plastic products, and that can be really difficult to navigate and sort of understand what the impacts of those are and how to use them safely and dispose of them properly.
Yeah, well, I guess this goes to your work, right, Kate, which is trying to create policy or influence policy around plastic and plastic consumption in Australia. What is WWF doing to stop plastic?
So we have the ultimate goal or vision of no plastic entering into nature. And in order to achieve that, we look at some of the policies and the mechanisms and the schemes that need to be in place to make sure that plastic stays in the economy and is kept out of nature, and also to seriously reduce the amount that we consume and use. One of the pieces of work that we've been doing for the past couple of years in Australia is producing a plastic scorecard each year. Mm-hmm. And that tracks the progress within the states and territories, across all states and territories, on phasing out some of the most harmful and unnecessary plastic products. We've seen some really amazing progress in that scorecard since we started producing it in 2019 up till today in 2022.
Who's doing best on the scorecard? Which state or territory is topping the class?
This has been very hotly contested, and there has been a lot of movement among the states and territories.
All right.
So we can see that South Australia was an early adopter. They've had a container deposit scheme for decades. They've really been kind of the front runners for the past couple of years. More recently, we've seen WA shoot into first place. They developed a really ambitious plastics plan. Also, they're joined by the ACT and Queensland, who have had some pretty similarly ambitious plastics plans come out over the last couple of years. So in most of those states and territories, if not now, then in the next year or two, you'll see a lot of products just disappear off the shelves.
There's nothing quite like a bit of competition. Being from the ACT now, I just need to see the ACT on top. So I'm going to do anything I can to help our government get rid of plastic. I can't let Western Australia win, Kate. I just can't let them.
What's really interesting and great to see as well as the progress that we've seen with the plastic scorecard is in kind of stopping those products from coming onto the market. At the other end, we've seen some great research from CSIRO or CSIRO looking at the levels of trash that are actually on the beach. All of this evidence is starting to kind of match up. And so CSIRO's found, a 30% reduction in beach litter over a couple of years or decades, which is really great news. And it really shows that a lot of these policies, particularly container deposit schemes, can have a real impact.
That's awesome. I mean, I know, like, just from my own anecdotal evidence, like when you live in a city like Berlin, which has a really robust container recycling scheme, I think you get like 20 euro cents back for every bottle you return. You just almost never see bottles anywhere on the street. It's just a litter that does not exist, as far as I was ever aware. I think just because it's people are just so much more actively trying to recycle them.
Yeah, absolutely. There are schemes that, capture huge amount of those products. We're not there yet. Australia's kind of recovery and recycling rates, even within those schemes, are not as good as they could be. And yeah, partly that's to do with price. You know, if you put a value on a product, it's going to retain that value. And rather than being treated as something that you just chuck on the ground or chuck in the bin, then it retains that value and it's redeemed and it's kept in the system. And all of those kind of schemes are absolutely things that we've been working towards for years within WWF.
What's the craziest thing that has plastic in it?
Crazy can be a product that just doesn't need to exist, or it can be really unexpected, right? So I would say cocktail stirrers are a prime example of something that no one really needs. I would say straws are a great example of something that very few people need. Some people need them for medical purposes, but if you don't need them for medical purposes, you've got a mouth and you've got a glass. And that's a great way to drink a drink. Microplastics in lipstick. There you go. That's a little unexpected.
Yeah, yeah. I once saw in a supermarket you could buy peeled bananas that were wrapped in plastic. You know, like they'd taken away that
step. You know what, Carlo? Do not even get me started on the unnecessary amount of plastics that are used to package our food. And some countries, interestingly, have gone really directly tackled this and gone down the route, for example, France has, of banning unnecessary plastic packaging on fruit and vegetables.
Wow.
So where the case can't be made that packaging, for example, protects or really extends the life of that fruit and vegetable, if it's purely there for convenience, France has said you just can't do it.
Well, okay, here's a question for you about my life. Every morning, I take Glad Wrap and I wrap it my entire bed in Glad Wrap so it doesn't get dusty during the day. Good or bad use of plastic, would you say?
Yeah, that's not a difficult question at all, Carlo.
Yes, good use.
Yeah, very few people would recommend that.
Interesting.
I imagine it's also incredibly expensive.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm going through just the amount of plastic that I'm having to go. I have to keep using my car to go back and forth to the shops all day just to get enough Glad Wrap to be able to wrap my whole bed. It's, it's costing me a lot in fuel and Glad Wrap.
Yeah, not a super king, I hope.
Biggest bed you've ever seen. I had it tailor-made. And I said, I'm not going to let a speck of dust get on this bed. It's so precious to me.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that your bed is a pristine environment, Carlo, because I'm telling you, where that plastic is ending up is really not so pristine at all.
It is staggering, though, the amount of your needless plastic use. You mentioned that people can use things like keep cups and stuff to reduce the amount of plastic they're using every day. What are some other simple things that people could do to drastically impact the amount of plastic that they have in their lives?
Stopping wrapping the bed in plastic is a great start. Now, after you've done that,
okay,
and you fancy a coffee on the way to work, make sure you remember your reusable cup from home. Or if you forget your reusable cup, you can sit down for 5 minutes and drink it Italian style in the cafe before you leave. This is a great example of a product that we just really don't need, and there are really viable alternatives. Now, not only are you changing your behavior, Carlo, and by taking your reusable cup, you know, you're saving up to 500 disposable cups a year, but you're also, without knowing it, potentially influencing other people's behavior. So there's some really amazing research around that shows that people are influenced by seeing other people exhibit a certain behavior. Now, this is not surprising. We're social animals, right? But other people seeing you with a coffee cup and other people seeing another 10 or 15 people, you know, in the cafe ordering their coffee in a reusable cup, that leads to behavior change as well. There's also some really interesting research that shows that big pieces of macroplastics or big pieces of plastic litter that are in the environment can act as what's called beacons. So that can actually attract other litter. It almost normalizes the behavior. So people see it and they kind of think it's okay. So by not throwing out your coffee cup, by taking a reusable cup, you are possibly unknowingly influencing others to take up those sustainable behaviors. What you really need to do is reinforce that by stopping wrapping your bed in plastic wrap on a daily basis as well. Because, you know, this is about walking the walk as well.
Well, look, baby steps, Kate. You know, I'm going to try and take on board what you've said. But I also am intrigued in that idea that if people see plastic waste, it encourages further plastic waste. It kind of goes, I guess, to that idea that if you see a smashed window, you know, that smashed window analogy, like if you see a smashed window, you're more likely to smash the other windows. If everyone is using a keep cup around you, obviously you're going to want to fit in. It's that kind of group mentality.
Yeah, very much is. That behavior becomes normal. And then all of a sudden, as a country, we're not using 1.8 billion disposable cups and burying them every year.
I've even seen just some workplaces, people taking the coffee cups from their workplace if they've forgotten a keep cup and just taking that to the cafe and that becoming a very normalized thing.
Yeah, this is an awesome lo-fi solution, isn't it? Like revolutionary. You don't need to buy a new product, Carlo. You've got cups at your workplace and you've got cups in your home. And guess what? They'll do the job of holding a liquid. You can even walk around with it.
Well, I've got two hands. I'll just put them under the nozzle now. It is a personal question for you, Kate, but who's your white whale? Like if there is one big plastic producer or plastic user out there, who would you most want to get?
It's really the packaging sector as a whole that has for decades really been pumping this stuff out to make our lives simpler and more convenient, but not taking any responsibility for it past the point of sale.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big problem.
Yes.
Because, you know, you and I can pick up a product at the supermarket. It's clearer now what we're supposed to do with it once we've used because, you know, there are labeling schemes, much better recycling infrastructure that existed sort of, you know, a decade or two ago. We don't have a lot of choice in terms of opting out of plastic products. And we are kind of bombarded with apples chopped up in plastic. There's a great packaging for apples, Carlo, and it's called Apple Skin. Same goes for bananas and oranges.
Are there times when plastic is a necessary evil, do you think?
Yeah, so the medical sector is a really good one to point to, although you'll find an awful lot of doctors and nurses that are absolutely horrified by the amount of plastic waste that's produced within the medical system.
Mm.
Those systems aren't really optimized to be kind of environmentally responsible, and there is a lot of improvements that could be made.
Mm.
So I think the bottom line there is, yes, a lot of plastic is probably necessary and justifiable, but not necessarily the amount that is being produced and used. Plastic also has an important role to play in reusability and keeping stuff fresh. I've got Tupperware in my drawer that I've had for a really long time that is really durable and means that I can go to shops and buy products without plastic packaging and then take it home and keep it and wash it and do it again and again and again. So that's another great example of durable plastic products that can be used again and again and again and refilled. And then at the end of their life, they've got a really clear pathway to be recycled rather than being buried, burnt, or worse, leaked into the environment. When you kind of look at the way plastic moves around the world, not just in the oceans, but in markets, you kind of come to the conclusion that also there is a role for global governance and global regulations and cooperation between governments that is really, really important here because a lot of these companies are producing products in one country and shipping them to another. A lot of waste used to be sort of shipped around the world as well for treatment and management.
Yeah, well, that's what we do a lot of our recycling in Australia, right? A lot of our recycling is sent overseas to be processed.
Well, not anymore. So a couple of years ago, the Chinese government, which was a big recipient of the world's plastic waste, decided it wasn't going to take unsorted waste anymore, or even it wasn't going to take most plastic waste. So a lot of companies that were shipping their waste overseas were really forced to ideally take responsibility for managing that themselves. Some of them just found other places to send it. But Australia certainly was one of those that decided to ban the export of plastic and other waste types and just get on with building the infrastructure to deal with it. A lot of the work that WWF has been doing kind of moving towards and arguing the case for a global treaty to stop plastic pollution. That decision by UN member states or governments was taken at the start of this year. So that will happen over the next couple of years. We will have a global treaty within the next 2 or 3 years that really recognizes that even, you know, individual people, individual companies, individual governments can only really have a certain amount of impact on this problem. It's very much a global problem.
Wow. And then we just need to get out there in our boats and start scooping up all the plastic in those vortexes. Bing, bang, boom, shoot it into the sun.
Carlo, you've really put your finger on it there. We can't keep cleaning up the plastic. Mm. We've got to go right up the food chain or the plastic chain to get to the top where this stuff is produced and consumed and make sure it's designed in a way that can be reused and refilled, not designed in a way that is meant to be used for 12 seconds and then tossed.
No, look, it's a really important problem. And I mean, it's been terrific talking to you about it. It's lovely to hear about Pretzel. I'm so glad to hear that he's out there having the best time of his life recycling plastic in the ocean. So at the end of every episode, we'd like to talk about a little scat fact. Do you have a favorite scat fact?
Carlo, have I got news for you? I haven't just got one little mini nugget of a fact. I've got a scat fact package.
That's why we bring you on, Kate.
Absolutely. I've got to do a shout out to my little boys, Tom and Will, for helping me to settle on this. There's so many amazing poo facts in the world, and it was really difficult. But we settled on penguins, and specifically we settled on Adelie penguins and chinstrap penguins, both of whom are capable of projectile pooping up to 1.5 meters.
That's how far they can poo.
That's how far their projectile poop goes.
Why didn't they use that during social distancing? You need to be as far away from each other as these penguins can poo.
Exactly. They do this to keep their nest clean, but the irony is that they are so close to their neighbors that they often poop out of their own nest and into their neighbor's nest. The other amazing thing about these penguins is that the amount of poop that they produce without moving means that it kind of builds up in one spot. It's sometimes pink in color and it can be seen from outer space. Now, scientists are doing really amazing things with these poop pictures. They're using it to map colonies and understand, you know, where the colonies are and what the size of the colonies are and the population of those. But close up, what they're also doing is that they're analyzing the poo to understand changes in penguins' diets over time. Now, I know you're wondering what this smells like, right, Carlo?
That's always my first question, Kate, and I'm glad you head me off at the pass.
So it apparently smells like used cigarette tobacco combined with rotten shrimp left outside to ferment in the sun.
That's a smell I know well. I can picture it now. See, I have a scat fact for you, Kate, and you might enjoy this because I believe penguin poo is also called guano, right? Bat poo is also called guano, and bat poo was traditionally used to make gunpowder for muskets.
I did not know that.
Yeah, they mixed bat poo with, I think, sulfur and some other bits of saltpeter maybe to make gunpowder. So they're just like carrying pouches of bat poo around.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. I have been into one of those bat poo caves in Borneo. That's a sensory experience.
Yeah. Did it take you back to the battlefield, Kate?
It was pretty stinky in there.
Yeah. Well, look, Kate, thank you so much for being part of Scat Chat today. It was terrific to talk to you about plastic, if not a little bit terrifying. But yeah, keep up the good work.
Thanks very much. Pleasure.
Thank you for joining me to get to the bottom of so many incredible scat facts. If you would like to find more ways to make a real difference, head to wwf.org.au/scatchat and get involved today. If you've enjoyed the show, please like and follow us here and follow WWF Australia on your favourite social media channel to stay up to date on all things scat. I'm Carlo Ritchie and this has been Scat Chat, WWF.